This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Sex trafficking and corruption have been the subject of rumors in Portsmouth, Ohio for years, and now we know more. The Cincinnati Inquirer spent a year investigating those rumors. What the paper found in a discussion with three of the journalists who told the story coming up. Today we will also look at a downtown Cincinnati hotel that got a scathing review from the mayor. What motivated him to speak out? But first, a Mason family was killed in a terrible tragedy involving a wrong-way car crash. There may be a solution forthcoming for the mudslides on Columbia Parkway, and the city of Cincinnati is looking to improve traffic flow downtown. Let's begin the Friday News Review with WCPO transportation reporter Pat LaFleur. Welcome back, Pat.
Thanks, Michael.
And Cincinnati Inquirer transportation reporter Hannah Sparling. Good to see you, Hannah.
Good to see you, too.
If you want to weigh in on any of these issues involving transportation, give us a call, 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets there. Hannah, let's start with you. We're talking about one-way crashes today because of a tragedy involving a local family, 51-year-old Timmy Thompson, 50-year-old Karen Thompson, and their 10-year-old daughter, Tessa, all died on Sunday. What do we know about what happened?
Yeah, so basically, the Thompsons were headed south on 75. There was a car that was initially headed north on 75 in the northbound lanes, but she traveled over and started going north in the southbound lanes, and they kind of crashed head-on, and all three members of the Thompson family died.
Which part of 75 are we talking about?
I don't remember the exact mile marker. Do you remember, Pat?
I don't remember either, but it would clearly be far up enough out of the city where 75 stops being a road with a median in the middle, right? Mm.
So the driver was identified as 21-year-old Abby Michaels. She was previously reported to be in critical but stable condition at Miami Valley Hospital. Has that changed? Do we know?
That's the last update I've heard.
Okay, what kind of charges, if any, do we expect her to face?
You know, they're investigating it as a vehicular homicide. So that's very, very serious. I believe you can get up to 8 years in prison or something like that.
And I know that they're investigating the possibility of impairment as well, which would, I think, increase that to aggravated vehicular homicide,
driving impaired would make it that.
So then what do we know about her and her condition during the time of that accident?
You know, so we don't have, this is all just kind of, I guess, speculation at this point. We don't have the official blood test results, but the medics, according to one police report, said she was basically frothing at the mouth and that the froth was beer. She was dressed in St. Patrick's Day garb, had a beer mug, a temporary tattoo on her cheek.
This was Sunday. This was St. Patrick's
Day. This was St. Patrick's Day, yeah.
Yeah. So what do we know about the Thompson family and the loss that they leave behind?
Yeah, well, we know Karen was a teacher. She taught kids with multiple disabilities at Taft Elementary, CPS. Tessa was a fourth grade student at a Catholic school in Mason. I don't know much about Timmy. Less has seemed to come out about him, I think, just because it hasn't come from schools.
So following the tragedy, Hannah, you looked into some statistics involving wrong-way crashes. So what did you find?
It was kind of shocking because these tend to stick out in our minds, I think, because they are so tragic and so catastrophic when they do happen, but they're incredibly rare. It's like 0.01% of all crashes. So we have about 300,000 crashes in Ohio every year, and about 30 of those are going to be wrong way. And that's not someone dipping into the other lane for a second. It's someone going typically the wrong way on a divided lane highway.
So rare but deadly. What's the percentage of the deadly or the rate of the deadly impact of some of these crashes?
I don't have the exact rate of how often it's fatal, but from the stats I looked at, it's about 30 a year and then 15 deaths usually.
Is there any, did you find that there was any type of road? I mean, you said where there's a divided lane, but is it highway? Is it state roads? Are they just city streets?
I think that's the problem and why there's a little bit of a question about what in the world are we supposed to do? There's not really a cluster. It's not like they're all happening on one highway or on one ramp. They're just kind of happening all over. And the majority of the time, alcohol is a factor. And so that's, you know, if someone chooses to drive drunk, there's no policy you can put in. That's already illegal. So you can't really legislate and make them stop doing that.
Okay, Pat, the city of Cincinnati is looking to make adjustments after some studies about traffic signal patterns and how curb space is used downtown, among other issues. So far, what do we know about, let's say, stoplights?
Well, so one thing we know right away, and I think everyone was anticipating this, but those traffic signal timings are going to change throughout downtown. Basically, pedestrians will be given more time to cross in crosswalks, and as a result, vehicles will see a reduction in the amount of time they have to move through an intersection.
So these changes are the result of some studies, like multiple studies that were all going on at the same time. What prompted the city to look into these issues?
Well, the study took more than 2 years to come about. Lawmakers were very eager for a long time to get these results, but it came from initial problems that the streetcar was facing as far as traffic congestion downtown. Everyone's known for years that congestion downtown is always bad. It's been 25 years since the city even re-examined its traffic signal timing downtown. So what they were seeing initially was the streetcar would get stuck in traffic. That would cause delays and underperformance from the streetcar. So city council ordered this traffic signal study, and that kind of blossomed over the next 24 months or so into including curb space studies and other kind of pedestrian safety fixes that could be implemented, especially since in that meantime, we've seen a lot more attention being paid to pedestrian safety as well as other kind of congestion issues.
So then it sounds like the beneficiaries of these studies, if some reform is implemented, will be pedestrians, the streetcar itself. And
I think the streetcar is a maybe, as far as I understand it.
Yeah.
That's cost like $80,000.
Yeah, that requires council action.
Okay,
yeah.
So what is it? What's the change then?
It'd be four lights that would be timed specifically for the streetcar. So the streetcar would have, as far as I understand it, some kind of remote, so the light would basically stay green for it.
Yeah, so there are certain intersections currently that have a streetcar-specific signal that is worked into the traffic signal cycle.
Yeah, so that's a situation where cars are stopped, but then the streetcar gets the green light to go ahead first before the cars are allowed to move.
Right.
Where it's kind of switching from one side of the road to the other.
Yeah.
Right, and so they want to install four more of those at a cost of about $20,000 each. So that's something that council will have to approve. And I think there's one other item that requires council approval that's
yeah, I know the timing for pedestrians was automatic. I believe that's something we have to do to stay in line with federal guidelines.
Okay, so what do they expect could be the benefit to the streetcar if these new signals are implemented?
Well, if it's not getting stuck in traffic like it is now, that means it'll theoretically be easier to make the 12 to 15 minute arrival headway times that it's currently contractually obligated to maintain due to its agreement with the federal government. It hasn't been doing that since it launched, really. It's kind of fluctuated in terms of its performance there, but by and large, it's not hitting those arrival times like it should. And this was kind of the very first solution that was pitched less than a month after the streetcar launched. So now we're in a position where city council can take an action to see if that would work. But again, it'll come at a cost.
Has there been any discussion or analysis of the impact that just downtown drivers have on the streetcar? There has been a certain adjustment for those of us who drive downtown and now seeing this big machine coming down. Has there been any impact in general by drivers who might not know any better how to stay out of the way? Or,
well, I see kind of conflicting reports about vehicles blocking the tracks or parking where they shouldn't. Delivery vehicles have been a big problem downtown for the streetcar when they, pull over to the curb and end up parking along the tracks. The city is saying that that's improving, but, the numbers, that's an interpretation of the data. So it's kind of unclear whether or not it's actually getting better. I think people's awareness of it is probably increasing just because that's what happens over time. And, the more we sit here and report on it, the hopefully the more aware people will become. But as far as navigating the downtown streets with the streetcar, I think people are still adjusting to that for sure.
Okay, so this is some reactive policy based on how the streetcar is performing up to now.
Absolutely.
Has there been any discussion about why perhaps these signals weren't placed at the beginning of this project launching? Has anyone raised that concern or question?
Well, I think a lot of people have asked that question. I don't think I've ever heard an answer to it.
The only answer is that they wanted to study it first. Some people don't believe that. Some people do.
Are there any examples from other cities where the streetcar has been implemented, where maybe there is some better street policy to help the flow that Cincinnati could learn from?
Well, I know that Kansas City has had pretty tremendous success with a system that is very similar to ours. I know that they had a traffic signal prioritization kind of in place with their launch. And, you know, now almost 3 years later, they've already approved an expansion of their streetcar. So one could deduce that having that in place was one component toward making that system successful. I think we still have to wait here to see if that will play out the same way here.
So we all have those stoplights in whatever part of town that we live in where we sit at and we think, why is this light so long? What right. is this? What is the point of this? But there must be some analysis or science behind this, right? Did that get explained at all in this analysis? This may be an inappropriate question for reporters, but if you know, I'm curious personally, and maybe some listeners are as well, what goes into determining how long you need to be sitting at a red light?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. I know that one thing they did mention was, and Hannah alluded to this before, with some of these kind of updates to federal guidelines about, you know, how fast a pedestrian can walk across a certain length of street, how quickly that pace moves, and how much time the average pedestrian would need to get across the street. As a very frequent pedestrian myself, I think all of us in this booth fall into that category. I think we would appreciate having as much time as possible to cross the street. So I know that plays into it. As far as thinking about how long should a driver sit at a red light? I'm not aware of the theory behind that.
I think they're looking at average daily traffic on a certain route. So it's how many cars do you have to get through? Like, obviously, the route that's more heavily traveled needs a longer light. You're going to be backed up there. But there is supposed to be a very scientific timing to a downtown so you don't get gridlock.
Yeah. I mean, you can sit in a city council meeting at any of the city across town and hear somebody come and complain about why is this light so awful. And usually you hear that this is, this might be a state transportation department situation. So there's like some very high skilled engineers who are making your life hell and making you sit at that intersection for longer than you care to.
Well, and I mean, at the end of the day, it all comes down to what mode is being prioritized, right? So, or the flow of what mode is being prioritized. So are we prioritizing the flow of automobiles? Are we prioritizing the flow of people on foot? Whatever the science shakes out to be, I think that's the motivating concept, is how to create a situation where all modes can be equally accommodated. Whether that plays out in practice, I think, is a different question.
And Hannah, what's the impact on parking meters?
They're looking to add some more parking meters. I don't think the plan was super clear yet as far as exactly what they'll do. But it's basically, the idea was, we have a limited space downtown. We want to get as much money and as much cars parked in it as possible.
All right, let's talk about Columbia Parkway, because it's had some mudslide problems. It's been shut down multiple times.
Has it?
Yes, indeed. It's a little muddy and murky over there. Hannah, what can we expect next?
I think we can expect next a lot of debate about what exactly we should do and how much exactly we should spend. So everyone is saying this is quite bad and we need to do something other than what we're doing now, which is basically wait for a mudslide, clean it up. Wait for a mudslide, clean it up. So they're looking at building a new retaining wall, which is going to be,
I think they estimated around 10
million.
They
estimated around 10, but I've heard people questioning that already.
Yeah. I've heard people estimate as much as $30 to $50 million is what would really be necessary.
Well.
And that might not just be about the retaining wall. That might also include other sorts of landscaping and structural improvements they can make to the hillside itself. But, you know, it's no secret that it was just kind of built wrong in the first place. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. So I think $10 million is probably lowballing it.
Is that something the city's going to have to pay for, or are there other funds available for it?
There's a chance for some federal money. I think that's maybe a long shot.
I think that was kind of the reasoning behind the whole debate this week about what it would mean to declare it a city emergency. Mm-hmm. Right? There was a long discussion in city council this week about that. What that would actually mean as far as releasing city funds, or what that would mean in terms of being able to reach out to the state or the feds for money for this. FEMA was mentioned as a possible.
Yeah, well, Governor DeWine declared an emergency on Friday in 37 counties. Hamilton was one of those. So, I talked to an ODOT spokesman then, and he said that means that anything that's done, I think it was within 180 days, the federal government could theoretically pay for in full. After that, it'd be an 80-20 split. But that's an application process.
Right.
You have to be determined, like, the most emergency ness.
Right. How do you declare emergency to build a wall? This all sounds so familiar.
Oh,
there's a lot of this discussion going on. So you both wrote about the walking school bus program at Cincinnati Public Schools after it was discovered that the district failed to properly manage grant money awarded for it, according to an audit by the U.S. Department of Justice. First, what is this program, the walking school bus?
Well, it's basically a program, and it was, I think it was implemented ultimately at about 8 elementary schools or so. It was meant to be much bigger and to grow a lot. But the idea is basically you don't get a school bus if you live close to your school within a mile or so. So it was a group of adults that would walk elementary school kids to school, and they were supposed to play some good behavior games and do some more like kind of scientific things while they were doing it. But the basic idea was walk kids to school, make sure they're safe.
Okay, and Pat, what did this audit determine?
Well, it determined a lot of things. Generally, the money used was not used appropriately as far as the scope of the project initially was laid out. So there were some initial budgetary changes that occurred that were deemed to be inappropriate. Probably the most disturbing thing that came out of the report was the way they called them conductors, the walking school bus conductors, the adults who would be walking these children to school. The application process wasn't as rigorous as it should have been, and they did find a little more than a dozen conductors had criminal history that would have been deemed inappropriate to be working with children.
Okay, so what are the repercussions? What's next?
Well, it was supposed to be a $5 million grant spread out over time, so the district lost that. I mean, that's gone. They'd spent $700,000 already, and there's a question about whether some of that's been reimbursed, some of it has not. So there are questions about whether they'll get their full reimbursement for what they spent, and even whether I think they might have to pay some back.
I think they were reimbursed about $700,000 and then had spent another
$500,000. Oh,
yeah, you might so whether or not or how much of that $700,000 needs to be paid back, I think, is in question. And then, you know, the DOJ is saying you should not give them the other $500,000 that they've spent, and we haven't reimbursed them for yet. So
they're, of course, arguing that they should give
right.
it.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the school district has their own response to a lot of these allegations, and those are all laid out in the report also.
WCPO's Pat LaFleur and the Cincinnati Inquirer's Hannah Sparling. Thanks to you both for joining us today.
Thank you. Always happy to be here.
Up next, the mayor of Cincinnati had some strong words for a downtown hotel. What he said and what's next is coming up. Plus, a year-long investigation by the Cincinnati Inquirer looked at years of rumors about sex trafficking and corruption in Portsmouth, what the journalists found. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. What's worse than a bad Yelp review? Maybe when the mayor says your hotel is really bad.
That's just a terrible place to stay. And we don't want people to have a bad impression of Cincinnati. And so we're hoping that we can either put it out of business or it'll change hands sometime soon.
That was Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley talking about the Millennium Hotel downtown. So why is he so upset about it? Here to discuss is WCPO digital reporter Paula Christian. Welcome back, Paula.
Thanks for having me.
If you got questions or comments, or maybe you want to leave a review about the Millennium Hotel, give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments or your tweets. So, Paula, this is rather unusual for a mayor to take aim at such a prominently situated business. I mean, this isn't a strip club or some hole-in-the-wall bar that's causing problems for people. Why is he so upset about this hotel?
Well, Mayor Cranley has been trying to find a solution to this for years and years and years. So I think he's just reached his breaking point. The owners of the Millennium, They're owned by a Singapore investment group, and there have been multiple times over the years where they've gotten close with city and county leaders to either agree to a sale, agree to renovate it, agree to make improvements, and then at the last minute, it falls through. And from what Mayor Cranley told me is each time they come back to the city a year or two later, somebody else is in charge. The negotiations start all over again, and they ultimately get nowhere.
So this is a hotel that changes hands frequently, is what he's suggesting.
I think he's they have had the same owners, but the ownership of the investment company that owns the hotel is changing hands frequently.
But again, this isn't some small establishment. This is, I believe, it was
the biggest hotel in the city.
It's the largest one. So most rooms, and it's very tall. It's right there in the heart of downtown Central Business District.
Yeah, and it's attached to our convention center, which, it's 872-room hotel. It's connected to the Duke Energy Convention Center by a skywalk. So a lot of people that come to Cincinnati don't know anything about the city, might be here for a convention. They think, I'm going to stay here because it's close. And then they get there and, you know, you read the reviews and they're horrified. Many people are very upset at the condition of the rooms. Some of them leave. And I was reading a lot of the reviews to Mayor Cranley. And I think that's when he just got so frustrated that, you know, he's working really hard to improve the city. People come here who haven't been here before and they leave with an impression that Cincinnati is less than because they stayed in a bad hotel.
Is this a hotel that people are choosing to stay at downtown because its rooms list for less expensive a rate than?
Yes. Well, their rooms are dramatically cheaper than other rooms downtown. So that is a drawing point. And some of the positive reviews on some of these trip websites say that it wasn't that bad. The rooms were so much cheaper. And for me, it was worth it.
So you mentioned that some of the guests don't like the rooms. What do we know about what's got people so upset or cautious about the hotel? What are we talking about in terms of the bad experience that they're having?
Well, in reading through the reviews, it is outdated. Everything from loud, noisy heating and AC units, mold and mildew in the bathroom, carpets that people wear white socks and they walk around the room and they're black. Carpets that have stains, bed bugs. Prosecutor Joe Dieters was talking about that they have a vermin problem with mice. So there's some pretty disturbing things going on there.
Is there a restaurant in there?
There is a restaurant in there.
So they've got a restaurant too. Have you heard anything about the quality of that?
I have not been there. I did read through some of the outstanding, some of the things that city health inspectors have pointed out. And I don't think it's anything that maybe rises to the level of some of our worst violators, but I did see some mouse droppings.
Saw this.
I didn't. I haven't been there, but
you
in
saw
the
references.
Yeah.
Okay. So the mayor met with Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieters, I'm assuming not over drinks at the Millennium Hotel, but they got together and they were talking about a public nuisance lawsuit. So what does that mean?
Well, in talking to Joe Dieters, it would be a temporary injunction that would temporarily shut it down and force them to make repairs. Now, then it would be up to a judge within 30 days to decide if it stays permanently closed. Joe Dieters was saying he hopes that, and what in his experience usually happens is it forces a sale. It forces the owners to sell it to a different owner who would, in their hopes, either tear it down and build something else or refurbish it.
Have we heard from the hotel's ownership or management?
I reached out to them. There was a spokesperson out in California who got back to me and gave me a prepared statement. And she said they were not aware of any specific nuisance violations from either guests, neighbors, or employees. And she said that they are aware of some issues with the convention center and they're willing to try and work with the city.
They mean issues raised by the convention center, or they were saying that the problems may lie with the convention center?
My impression was that it was issues with the convention center.
So this spokesperson, was this somebody with the investment company, or is Millennium the chain that is represented by the flag here?
Millennium is the spokesperson, I believe, was from an outside PR firm that was that works for Millennium Copthorne Hotels, which is the London-based hotel chain that owns the Millennium Cincinnati. And that chain is controlled by a Singapore investment company as the majority shareholder.
So there would be a time frame, it sounds like, if this public nuisance lawsuit is filed and this injunction takes place and the hotel's unable to operate. It sounds like there is a time frame for them to get their act together.
Well, I think that Joe Dieters would like to move very quickly. He said he's instructed his civil division to start working on it immediately. They are going to be collecting from the city things like affidavits from the city solicitor, from the mayor about failed negotiations to sell the property, and health reports on some the quality of what the rooms, the restaurant, any violations, if there's police runs, anything like that. They're going to try and gather to build their case.
You can go just about anywhere across the region, even in the city of Cincinnati proper, and find hotels that have terrible reviews online that you could probably walk in and say, this is gross.
Absolutely.
Why this one? Why is this such a big deal?
Well, it's right in the heart of downtown.
It's the geography of it.
Yes. Well, and truthfully, it is having a dramatic impact on the size and scope of the conventions that they can draw to the city. And that is a big economic driver. Tourism and conventions, they supply $5 billion to the regional economy. And if they're having trouble booking large conventions because the hotel is just known to be not very good, then the city's losing money and the county's losing money. So that is the real push. Is to do something to improve the number of conventions that we're getting.
And interestingly, we have some very recent precedent for the Millennium Hotel situation because there was another downtown hotel that was targeted recently.
Yes, just 2 weeks ago, I was reporting on the Terrace Plaza Hotel, which is another sort of landmark property right in the heart of downtown. It's been in kind of a sad state for a number of years, and the city filed a public nuisance action against the owner of that hotel.
So what's coming of that?
Well, that they filed a very lengthy complaint against this. This is in state court, so it's sort of just getting started. They are seeking to shut it down, and there's coincidentally another buyer that wanted to buy that property, and there's a simultaneous federal court suit going on between the current owners of the Terrace Plaza Hotel and the company that said that they had the deal with the city, and they're trying to unwind the sale.
Paula Christian from WCPO. Thanks for coming down and talking to us today about this.
Thanks for having me.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Sex trafficking and corruption have been the subject of rumors in Portsmouth for years. The Cincinnati Inquirer spent a year looking into it. Joining us now to discuss what they found, our Inquirer investigative reporter, James Pilcher. Welcome back, James.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Inquirer higher education reporter Kate Murphy. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you.
And Inquirer photographer Liz Dufour. Thanks
Hi.
For coming in.
Thanks.
513-419-7100. If you have any comments or questions about this story that's been all over the place this week, you can also email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments or tweets and see if our journalist guest can answer that. Okay, so the headline for this story is Trapped and Trafficked, One Town's Dark Secret. This story started with rumors about sex trafficking and corruption in Portsmouth. It's about a two-hour drive east of here.
It's about 105 miles, but yeah, there's no real easy way to get there.
So, James, let's start with you. How did this issue first come onto your radar?
Well, a big shout-out to our editor, Bob Strickley. His day job is our breaking news editor, but he spent 3 years there. He lived there, and he's a Cincinnati native, but he lived there for in Portsmouth. He lived outside of Portsmouth, but he was the managing editor of the Portsmouth Daily Times. And so he knew the area and he knew people and kind of kept in touch. He, you know, he still has friends there. And then an ex-reporter that used to work for him posted on Facebook in December of 2017 excerpts of a federal law enforcement document that kind of made public what everybody had been talking about for decades about some of these individuals. And Bob saw it on Facebook and said, hey, do we want to take a look at this? And they asked me to take a look, and I drove out to Portsmouth, and I spent a month digging around, and I finally got a full copy of that document. And it just kind of ballooned and blossomed from there.
Kate, at what point did you and the team here realize that this was going to be a long one?
Yeah, I mean, I think pretty much from the onset, it was clear that this was going to take a lot of time because there were so many layers to it. You know, there's public officials and corruption. There's women who, you know, we knew that we needed to talk to really understand the story and see who the people who were most impacted, and then, you know, get in touch and just really verifying that all of this was true, what it looked like, how it all operated, and kind of what was keeping the operation running for so long, not necessarily undetected, but without anyone really trying to put a stop to it.
Liz, set the scene for us. What does Portsmouth look like? What does it feel like? What is that city like?
Well, I first went to Portsmouth probably 20 years ago to go antiquing. It's actually a very popular antique spot. So when you first drive into town, it's very cute, but there's definitely a lot of poverty, and you see a lot of boarded up windows. But it's right on the river, so it can be, you know, from our drone view, it's very picturesque. But there's a lot of poverty and a lot of problems that are kind of underneath.
Give us an overview of what you were able to find in this story, James.
Well, that for decades, powerful men, namely one specific man is the at the center of it. He's a defense attorney by the name of Michael Moran, who actually had been city councilman for a while, had basically, according to these women and according to the federal documents and other sources, had basically been running a sex trafficking ring, luring women in who have been addicted or got arrested for something and saying, hey, I can get you a little more lenient sentence if you go to work for me, if you do this for me, if you do that for me. So this involved several different layers of law enforcement. We had women telling us that police were involved. The affidavit actually mentions the fact that there might have been a judge involved, and we were able to follow up with that. That judge recently retired under controversy under a different subject, and he's now been suspended from all practice of law for 6 months for an unrelated issue. The biggest financial advisor in town was Moran's best friend. His name's Fred Brisker. He helped finance some of this and schedule some of this. It was basically, like I said, a tale of these women who were at their worst moment of their lives basically being taken advantage of by powerful men, and nobody being either people not able to or turning a blind eye to it for a long time.
So when we hear sex trafficking, we may end up with images of, I mean, something's happening on the border or something's right. Happening in Southeast Asia.
Or the Liam Neeson Taken movies, right?
Exactly.
So, you know, it's a fine line, because we even wrote about this in a separate story, the definition of sex trafficking versus prostitution. You might enter into it as a voluntary situation saying, yeah, I need the money, I'll do this. But then after a while, under these women were telling us that because possible law enforcement, they didn't have anywhere to go because they needed the money for the drugs, and coercion for drugs has been determined to be part of, in some states and federally, sex trafficking. So, you know, and these people were being sent. It wasn't just Portsmouth. They were going all over the country, Vegas, New Orleans, New York, other Atlantic City. Those are all in the documents.
513-419-7100. If you have any questions or comments about this story, while we have the journalist here. So this Michael Moran guy, I guess he's a relatively prominent attorney in that small city, was on the city council. And he was the one that you just referenced as being suspended from practicing for—
No, that was the judge.
That was the judge.
So, yeah, the judge is William Marshall. But
then Moran is still able to practice, and he's not faced any charges.
Not yet. No, not that we know of. We were told that by several sources there is an ongoing multi-jurisdictional law enforcement investigation going on to him. But of course, you know, which is understandable, they're not going to be public about it. But that been going on for a while. We don't know exactly how long. We don't know if it was because we started asking questions or not. But we do know that had started. But one of the big unanswered questions in all of this is where were the feds? That document was part of a drug investigation that wound up with 8 convictions, including one guy got sent away for 10 years in federal prison. But Moran never faced any charges. So what happened after that drug thing was done? Why didn't the FBI follow up on these other issues? Those are all unanswered questions.
So I'm looking at this picture of Mr. Moran, and he looks like a friendly old man. I mean, what is the guy? 73 years old, been around for a long time. Yeah. Tell us about, I'd like to hear from you, Liz and Kate, about the experience of working with him, knowing that these allegations and what seems like evidence is out there.
Well, the first time I met him was I was at court, and he walked up, and it's in the video, and he kind of smiles, and he kind of almost waves, and he was very friendly and joking. And as time progressed, he didn't like me very much. And one time I was in court, and he actually almost was hiding from me. Then the last time Kate and I were both there, he threatened us, and he was clearly not happy anymore that we were not following him, but in court taking his photo. So his demeanor totally changed over the course of the year. But you know, he is he's an older gentleman. His clothes are ill-fitting, and he lives right next to the courthouse, so he just walks back and forth. And
and in a way, he like has charisma, you know, like he feels really inviting and friendly when you first talk to him. And then there's also kind of like this moment where it's like a switch goes off and you can feel the tense, you know, sort of that tension, and see how he could be intimidating and how people could fear him.
Liz and I, he invited us into his office twice. The first time was just kind of like ad hoc, saying, okay, you're doing a story, you want to talk to me? Okay, come on by. So we got some video of him. We spent about an hour and a half there. And then the second time, we'd already gotten some women to say these were serious accusations. We said, look, we have these women now, a couple of them on the record. We need to get your response to this. And so he invited us back. So we actually had about two, three hours with him. And I would say he was everything from basically, you know, you could tell he's smart, but he's playing the, oh, I'm just a country boy, old lawyer, to being defiant, to being angry. So I kind of ran the gamut.
Let me read one of his quotes from your article, and this is a reference to the affidavit that you were able to obtain out of the Southern District of Ohio. Mr. Moran says, that affidavit was the product of a couple gals the FBI tried to set me up. This affidavit that you have says that they've been investigating me since the 70s. Now you think in 50 years, they would have maybe come up with something. So that does represent sort of the defiance that you referenced there, James. Yeah. Did you notice over the course of your reporting on him what might have triggered a change in him in terms of the way that he felt about you being in his business?
I think really the fact that we didn't go away. I mean, we were consistently showing up. We were consistently traveling to that town, and he knew when we were there. And I think, honestly, he thought we'd go away just like what seems like everyone else had. And we stuck with it. And I mean, even up until, you know, just a couple weeks before we published, you know, we were there in court with him, you know, just tracking this. And I think him seeing how serious we were about this and that we weren't going away and that we were publishing this story, that I think kind of set him in this, okay, they're really investigating this and this is going to come out.
You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're talking about the story that emerged after a year-long investigation into rumors of sex trafficking and corruption in Portsmouth. With us today are Inquirer investigative reporter James Pilcher, Inquirer higher education reporter Kate Murphy, and Inquirer photographer Liz Dufour. If you've got questions or want to join the conversation, give us a call, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Kate, you just said that this guy, this Mr. Moran, prominent lawyer there, former city councilman, started to realize that you weren't going away. And here you all came in from the Cincinnati paper. Tell us about that Portsmouth paper, James, that you referenced earlier. Did they not have the resources? Did they have a fear factor in approaching this type of story?
I hate to cast aspersions on other journalists, so this is a difficult, tricky topic for me particularly, but there seemed to be I have talked to other, besides Bob Strickley, who we mentioned before, I've talked to other reporters who have worked there who talk about how there were certain subjects you didn't write about or certain people that you didn't write about, or that if you did, you'd get in trouble. One reporter told me he got fired or suspended for writing up the fact that the local car dealer, the main car dealer in town, had been convicted on a DUI, that kind of thing. So it's a very small paper, and it's locally owned. So I think there was a more, you know, if you know, I don't know what's in their heads. So I don't feel comfortable answering that, but I just know what people have told me after working there for a while, that it became frustrating. And that I have talked to the reporter, the ex-reporter who initially released the documents, and she said it basically came down to, I wanted to run the story and they wouldn't run it. So it was kind of like a quit, I'm fired kind of a situation.
Let me read another piece sort of to that that sentiment here. It's from your article as well. During the interviews, some of the women cried, visibly trembled, or stole furtive glances over their shoulders to make sure they couldn't be overheard. These were the women who alleged sex trafficking took place. And I'm scared, I'm not going to lie, is a quote that one woman wrote in a message to you. Quote, I have to live here. I'm on eggshells right now. You don't know this town. And another one wrote, my family is kind of scared for me to talk. Too many missing women. How does an entire city allow this type of feeling to be so pervasive within it?
Yeah, it is a little crazy. We did not meet one person over the entire year who didn't know what was going on. And I did want to speak about the women who that did speak to us, who were incredibly courageous for talking. I mean, it is a small town. They are scared. The fear is real. There was one time that Kate and I stopped a woman who was walking on the street. And at first she approached us and she smiled at us. And
We were chatting.
Yeah. And she shook me. I introduced myself, shook her hand. And then I asked her about Mike Moran. And she turned around. She said, I can't say anything. And she turned around and practically ran from us. And that's the kind of, and there was other women who said, yes, I'll talk. And we would have an interview set up and they would not show up. You could tell that they wanted to, but they just couldn't make that final step.
And as a backdrop to all this, first of all, I got to give Kate and Liz all the credit here. I might have talked to two of the women. They talked to most of them, and that was a really heavy lift for them, and they handled that really, really beautifully. I was more the documents, accountability, doing interviewing the other side of it with all of this, but. The one thing I will say about the fear, and we spent some time with the sister-in-law of a woman named Megan Lancaster. She's kind of the poster child for that fear because she disappeared from her car. Her car was found missing, some blood on the seat, her wallet's still there, kind of half parked in the local fast food joint. And her poster's everywhere now, and they haven't found her. They don't know where she is, they don't know where she went. And her family hasn't given up on her, but, there were times that, her family saw her with Mike Moran. So there's that fear all over the town. There have been more than a dozen women missing or killed that have been in this life in Southern Ohio, Chillicothe on down to Cincinnati. Down to Portsmouth. So, Megan wasn't the only one, but she's kind of the poster child for that. So that's a big cloud hanging over the city.
Where did these women come from?
Many of them were from Portsmouth and grew up there. They were local girls that, often struggled with addiction. It's not really that typical picture of getting kidnapped and thrown into the back of a trunk and taken somewhere, or bringing people in from other countries and in this like servitude type image that often we have with sex trafficking and human trafficking. These were women who were taken advantage of by and exploited by men in power in their own town where they, you know, grew up, went to high school and have all of their friends. And, you know, many of them knew each other at different points. And so it really was a case of these local women, when they were vulnerable, being exploited.
And this is, again, against the backdrop of Portsmouth. And there's been other reporting on this, but Portsmouth has been known as like ground zero of the opioid epidemic. This is where pill mills started. You know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, they had pill mills up and down the streets there. So, you know, they had cars lined up from West Virginia all the way down to Florida coming up for the pills. So, you know, all of that against that backdrop. So you have these addicted women in trouble with the law, looking for any way they could get out. And here we are.
And he was a lifeline for them. And then he used that against them.
Yeah, it seems like he may have capitalized on their desperation. It mm-hmm. sort of sounds similar to the Judge Tim Nolan case out of Campbell County from last year.
It does.
Yeah. It's like there's some similarities.
Yeah, there are. And yes, and we actually mentioned that one of our sidebars talking about sex trafficking. We actually referenced that case as well. And that's the other thing is that there's other cases like this. There's a group of guys up in Minnesota, you know, they're called the Minnesota Nice Guys. But, you know, they're doing this.
So we got a call and a message from Rob. And I mean, he's asking what I guess is a fairly obvious question. It's somewhat addressed in your article. Where was law enforcement? And the interesting part of your article is that law enforcement was all over the place. I mean, federal officials were in here investigating some of this stuff. Right. But I guess his question just applies directly to your main character here.
Well, I think, and I've had some background conversations with some people in the law community. I think one of the difficult things has been to do cases like this in general is, like we faced, getting the women to talk. And I know this is going to sound politically incorrect, but they're not the most, you know, reliable witnesses at times. They have addiction issues. So getting them to come forward, be brave enough to take the stand and testify, because basically it is a he said, she said situation, that's tough for a prosecutor, whether you're at the state or federal level, to bring a case that you know you're going to get a conviction when you have that kind of doubt out there. So I think that's one of the challenges with these kinds of cases. You know, if you look even at the Robert Kraft case, owner of the Patriots, the women there don't want to testify. They're scared, even though they found them in the back room cooking on a hot plate. So, you know, that's all above all of this.
So we talked about the Portsmouth paper and the fear or difficulty that they might have had in covering this story. The Cincinnati Inquirer decided to take it on. I've only got about 30 seconds for you guys to answer this, but why was this important for the Inquirer to expend whatever resources it must have taken for you to do this?
Nobody else was going to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a national story. I mean, if you don't think it can happen in your backyard, you're wrong.
This was every town in America. That's why we poked. That's why we did it. That's why we wanted to show this as an example could happen anywhere.
Well, the story is online. You can read it at The Inquirer. I want to thank James Pilcher, Kate Murphy, and Liz Dufour from The Cincinnati Inquirer for joining us today to have this conversation
about
it. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our show can be found online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.